the MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast. I'm Matt Broughton, Research Lead at ExchangeWire. I'm delighted to be joined by not one, but two stalwarts of the C-suite at ExchangeWire. So starting off, we've got Rachel Smith, our CEO. Hello to you, Rachel.
Hi there, Matt. A stalwart. Oh, that's a great term.
Great to have you with us as always. And also Kieran O'Kane, ExchangeWire CSO. Hello to you, Kieran.
Hi, Matt. More of a bathroom stall than a stalwart.
We started with the toilet analogies early.
Indeed.
Excellent. This will be a grand one. We'll dive straight into the news this week. The countdown is finally on. Google has announced that it will finally begin the deprecation of third-party cookies within Chrome, starting with 1% of users within the first quarter of next year. This initial deprecation comes ahead of a broader phase-out for all Chrome users from Q3 2024. Privacy Sandbox, Google's replacement for third-party cookies, is now available within Chrome. So my first question to you guys is, and it's quite a minor one, is the Privacy Sandbox going to be a success? Kieran, let's start with you.
Jesus. I mean, should we put a time clock on? This is going to take a while.
I need some sound effects for the next one. I want to do the countdown, team tune. Will it be a success? Well, hard to say because there's been very little commentary around people using it. I think people will lean heavily into it because there is no real alternative to cookies at the minute. Everybody wants the same kind of party they had before, but there's no alcohol in the punch bowl anymore. It's just non-alcoholic vodka, i.e. water. So I think they'll probably, in the short term, lean into it. But there are so many problems with this. Alex Cohn, who is the Privacy Sandbox product manager, has sort of tweeted, this is the problem with Google as well, that the communication around Sandbox has been pretty
slim.
Sporadic is the word I would use. And not very focused and not they haven't articulated very well to the industry. But Alex is very good and I have a lot of time for him. But he tweeted out that Privacy Sandbox will have a opt-in for Europe because of GDPR, but an opt-out for the rest of the world. So if you're in the UK, you'd have to go into your Chrome settings and opt out of being sort of segmented in the Sandbox. I don't know what they're going to call it.
Is that actually going to get past privacy regulators?
Well, the Brits decided to leave Europe, as you well know, Rachel. So their regulations are a little bit lighter here and a bit more sort of, how do I say it, malleable. Whereas in the EU, have a fairly up and down around privacy, which is unfortunate for UK consumers, obviously. But Alex has sort of like highlighted sort of the problems with Sandbox in that in Europe, you still need an opt-in regardless. And that means that it's going to be very maybe ineffectual in Europe, effectively.
So just to qualify, you're talking about in Europe, it will be an automatic opt-out. So people will actually have to manually go in and opt-in in order to be included in whatever Sandbox's tracking, I'm using that word in inverted commas here because I know they won't be called tracking features, but in order to be included in whatever audience segmentation features, shall we call them, that Sandbox enables. And therefore, everywhere else in the world, it will be automatic opt-in. So if you don't want to be included in that, you'll have to go in and adjust your preferences.
Yes.
I don't like the way you said there, Kieran, you know, as you well know, Rachel, the UK isn't part of Europe, as though I'm personally responsible for that. Am I Boris Johnson? Am I David Cameron? No, I am not.
I was just highlighting the fact with some dramatic effect, right?
I liked the drama, but I don't want any insinuation that I'm that I'm a Brexiter.
Nobody thinks you're a flag waving fanboy, so it's fine. But it just shows you that even Sandbox is struggling with the current landscape. Like, so success, that's hard to say right now. But I do think a lot of people will probably lean into it because it's, you know, it's Google.
They have to.
Yeah, they have no other choice.
No,
but
that's it.
I would say if there are any Google people listeners, you are doing a terrible job of, a terrible job of educating the industry at large about this. I think there's very little out there where you've kind of gone into the weeds around this, how this will work. I speak to a lot of people in the industry and they don't know what's going on. I think you're doing a pretty shit job of educating the market and you should up your game.
I mean, no one enjoys no one enjoys being told how to do their job, especially by Kieran O'Kane. I think that's it may well be a fair criticism, Kieran, for anyone that's working for Google and listening. Apologies for the direct taunt. But, yeah, I mean, it would be good to have more of a open dialogue, but I suspect there's good reasons as to why there isn't an open dialogue available at the moment. They'll be busy working through various other more formal working groups and other industry bodies and associations. I would have to concur with Kieran. It doesn't feel like it's enough. It doesn't feel like people seem to really understand exactly what's happening. And so therefore, you know, wherever there's a bit of a vacuum, we can fill it with a whole load of, assumptions about about the quality of Sandbox and what the alternatives that are being put forward will actually have to offer the industry. I think it's the, you know, it's the million-dollar question, right? Will it actually work? At the end of the day, the question is, will it, you know, amongst other things, amongst upholding consumer privacy and creating a good user experience, will it actually enable advertising in a Chrome environment that delivers revenue to publishers and returns ROI to advertisers? And I think that's the big question. And go on, Kieran, because we've been talking about this a lot, right? Not just pertaining to the deprecation of cookies, but just what kind of value are advertisers and publishers getting in that Chrome environment anyway?
I think the problem I have with all this is if you're running two processes in play in parallel, right? One is you're going to deprecate third-party cookies and the other is you're trying to come up with a replacement for the cookie, right? A privacy-first replacement. And look, Google is doing probably the best job it can do. But I do think that not having a bulletproof solution before you turn off the lights is a problem for the industry as a whole. I think that's the part that's annoying people. Not angering. Nobody's angry. You just say, but annoying them because they have to figure out what they're going to do post-cookie, right? Particularly when you have most of the industry indexing to Chrome and, you know, the cookie within Chrome for sort of display, video and open web campaigns.
Don't you think that that's partly, I mean, the thing is, you know, Google were heavily criticized for pushing back the date schedule for deprecation of third-party cookie anyway a couple of years ago. Presumably, they did that because they didn't feel that they were ready and that the industry was ready. So now we're criticizing them potentially for bringing forward those deprecation plans to a small proportion of users within Chrome because we still don't really understand whether they're ready and not quite, and we don't really feel confident that the rest of the industry is ready. The argument, therefore, could be no one's ever going to be ready for this. Yeah. And it's quite possible that Google don't exactly understand how this is going to work until they test it. So I think it's reasonable for them to try and test it. I think it's just that it underscores what is one of the biggest issues in the industry and has been for a long time, which is that we're all way too reliant on these Google properties. And so it does feel like a massive inconvenience to everyone's life when they do anything with them. And it's just not a great place to be, right?
I could throw a bit of a curveball into this discussion that it really doesn't matter, right? Because you could argue that, you can easily argue, because it's the truth, that most of the open web is blind anyway regarding third-party cookies, because you have Safari and Firefox, Edge, all have, you know, kicked the third-party cookie to the curb. So I think, like, it's easy to get to break Google, I suppose, and I was doing that on behalf of the industry, but actually Google need to take this brave decision and just basically, you know, pull the trigger, because what it will do is it will push the industry towards metrics that matter, not vanity metrics, metrics that matter. And I think that will be better for the industry as a whole. Bring it on, Google. Don't hesitate. Sandbox, you can take the slap on the wrist, but just kill that thing. Get it over and done with. It's like a dying horse in the ground. Put a bullet in its head there, will you?
Or taking off a plaster very, very, very slowly.
Rip it off.
I think that's what the CMA has tried to do in terms of its work with Google. I think the rollout in terms of phasing out 100% of cookies in Q4 of next year, that's pretty much just been set by the CMA, because they've kind of gone, well, a lot of industry players are complaining about the inertia now, so we need to actually have a final cutoff date. I'm not entirely sure in terms of going from that 1% to 100% within kind of prime brand holiday season spending is going to be the best result for the industry. But yeah, it's going to be interesting. And I do agree with Kieran in the sense that it's actually going to probably solve a lot of the inertia that has been in the industry in terms of moving on to probably better privacy preserving technologies that are out there at the moment.
I mean, the other thing it does as well is that it gives them a precedent for whatever decisions they make from here onwards. So, you know, they roll it out to 1% of Chrome users. It's a shit show. I'm just a scenario, hypothesizing here. It's a shit show. Then they're able to go, okay, hang on a minute. We're not actually ready for full deprecation for Q4. And these are the reasons why not. Now, that might not happen. Maybe they roll it out to 1%. They learn some really interesting things. They refine some of their strategies for the technology tools that they're intending to use and apply in that environment, and actually, you know, they use the intervening two quarters to get to a better place, or they roll it out to 1%. No one knows what the hell's going on, and nobody, you know, and they disregard anyone's feedback on it, and then just unfold it to 100% by Q4. Who knows? But the point is, it gives them a starting point, right? So it's a precedent as well, and I'm sure it's a tactic. No, you know, not necessarily an underhanded one. I'm sure it is them genuinely going, we need to start this somewhere, so let's do this now.
Yeah, they definitely need some kind of roadmap at least. Well, sticking on a similar note, the Movement for an Open Web has recommended measures to level the playing field in ad tech. MOW has urged the UK Competition and Markets Authority to force the divestiture of Google's ad tech assets, plus join with antitrust authorities from other G7 nations to oversee digital standards. So my first question on this one to you guys is, can the ad tech playing field be leveled by these measures? Rachel, let's start with you.
I mean, I think it's really good that the Movement for Open Web is continuing to lobby for divestiture of Google's ad tech assets and continuing to keep a very strong focus on antitrust and anti-competition. And I think all authorities that are focused on that need to keep going. Whether the measures that they're currently focusing on are going to achieve what is needed is another matter. But there's no two ways about the fact that the way that it's not just Google, the way that Google and other businesses such as Apple have established their dominance in the marketplace has been partly through fortune, having particular products at particular points in history, in the history of our digital lives, that have enabled them to corner a share of market, and also a lack, again, another vacuum, right? A lack of oversight and regulation that's enabled them to strike deals and arrangements at a particular time when nobody was looking or nobody was looking at those particular things. And it's really played into their hands to give them a distinct commercial advantage. I think that it's reasonable, with the benefit of hindsight, to look at the last 10 years from where we're sitting now and say, even though we've been having these conversations for quite some time, maybe not quite 10 years ago, but certainly I'm going to say 6-7 years ago, you know, somebody needs to step up and do something about the competitive, anti-competitive stranglehold that some of these dominant tech players have got on parts of the advertising and marketing industry. I think it's reasonable that we now look back on that and say, okay, so there's a whole lot of stuff we didn't know now that we do now know. And so we really need to focus these measures and we really need to focus our energy on this. And we need to prepare for a future where it's not going to be Google and Apple that we're talking about dominating ownership of tech assets. It's going to be other companies that are not even yet known, probably. So this is, you know, I see some of these efforts and some of these movements as a way to establish a structure for tackling the dominance of modern technology businesses, whose power and commercial advantage is mostly data assets of the customers and consumers that they serve, right? It's not just about the products that they build and how people use them. It's about how we all interact with those. I thought it was really interesting that in that sort of list of particular initiatives that the Movement for Open Web was focusing their lobbying efforts on, they really highlighted that notion of bringing together some kind of standards across antitrust authorities within G7 nations. And I think that's super interesting because my entire experience of working in the advertising and marketing industry, I'm still dismayed at the number of, industry associations and authorities that attempt to standardize things. And one of the main issues is there's too many of those organizations. There's no real read across from organization to organization, just simply the goodwill of the people involved in those organizations, which in general is usually heading in the right direction. But there needs to be some oversight and we need to get some kind of uniformity across other countries, not least of all because it pertains to some of that privacy legislation that we were just discussing. It's a nonsense that we'll have one approach in one country and a completely different approach in another. And I think we need to see antitrust and anti-competition of modern technology businesses through that lens as well.
100%. And I'm glad you called out that finding because I found it really interesting as well. And, you know, how that model would work in terms of the G7 antitrust authorities clubbing together, it sounds great in theory, but I think in terms of recent antitrust cases, that Activision, Blizzard, Microsoft one springing to mind in terms of some regulators waving it through, others taking a closer look at it, and also GDPR that operates on kind of more of a fragmented framework. And we're still seeing criticism against the likes of the Irish DPC, for some saying lacks enforcement of that compared to other DPCs. So it is a really interesting model, but again, I'm not entirely sure how that would play out going forward. Kieran, what do you think of the measures outlined by the MOW?
Let me guess. Mr. Cynicism, enter the room.
I mean, it's just Google have won, right? They won the day they got DoubleClick. They're still winning. Even with Devestra, they'll still win. Like, the problem you have with Google is it's a killer, right? It's in its DNA. It wants to control and own everything. And that's why it makes so much money. I didn't realize this the other day. I actually thought their traffic acquisition costs, right? This came out from the court case, the DOJ court case, regarding the sweetheart deal they have with Apple, right? I just assumed the traffic acquisition costs on their non-endemic sort of products, I mean, anything outside of Google and YouTube, 30% of that was going to, publishers and partners. But it's not. Most of it's going to the deal around search with Apple and a few others, right? So it's actually making way more money than I thought on its sort of ad tech layer, right? Its ad network layer. That's like pure profit. Google's never going to give that up, hey, right? They'll do everything to keep it. So even if they force them to spin out GAM, and AdX, which I think is highly unlikely given the pace of these legislators, that they are just inept at what they're doing. They're never going to beat Google. Like, Even if they were forced to do that, Google would find a way to move the auction to the browser, right? So Chrome is a conversation that nobody's having, right? It's a choke point, as is Safari, right? These are choke points that both Google and Apple, particularly Google, have in their armory. So they own Chrome and then they own the search engine, right? So they literally have that first, 90% of the journey, right? And then the rest of it is the ad tech layer built in where they make a lot of their money. Now, I think this is all great, but you need something more aggressive here. Like, Google is never going, like, it's an animal, right? You can't beat it. The people working there are pretty arrogant and pretty strong in their own opinions about where they sit in the ecosystem, right? As has been evidenced in that trial so far, the emails that have transpired during the case, the DOJ case against Google. So I'm skeptical about all this stuff. I think it's great that the CMA and all the rest of them are kind of having coffee meetings about how we break up Google, but you're taking a toothpick to gunfight, not even a gunfight, a tank fight. Like, you know what I mean? Google's just going to roll over you, right? Keep it like they'll just throw money on it in terms of lawyers and lobbyists, and they'll just gum the system up and keep making money. Like, the day hear me out this, and then we can go back to this. Right? You've got to live with Google. You cannot beat them. And that is the only thing you can do now, right? If you try and take them on, you're going to lose. So you have to figure out a way to live with them and to exist with them. Thankfully, Google isn't in certain places, right? They've got YouTube, but they're not on TV. They're not on retail media. There are areas of ad tech where they're not, right? Where they are is in the publisher's hen house. Everybody uses GAM. We use GAM. ExchangeWire uses GAM. Every single 98% of the publishers in the UK, Europe, US, globally are using GAM as their main ad management layer, right? They give away that for free. And then they make money on the back end and AdX, right? The ad exchange. So they have, and what they, how to make that money is they bring AdWords in. So if you took Google out of that equation, publishers would lose money, right? So it's a way, you've got to look at this preservation-wise. I'd love to see Google be spun out and broken up, but they'll find a way to re-bring that money. They have a monopoly. Like, they have a monopoly. The company needs to be actually split up. YouTube needs to be taken out. Chrome needs to be taken out. It needs to be split up completely. Like, they just have a chokehold over the entire digital space. So what I'm trying to say is, don't bet the house on this, right? Because even if GAM and AdX are split out, there is a chance that they will find a way to bring auctions into Chrome and control it through Chrome. And I'm afraid that the legislators are not looking at that, because Google to say, we'll look after that. And then 12 months later, they're doing this in Chrome. So, yeah, I'm not afraid to look at me as if I'm hitting sort of a pessimistic tone, but I'm just telling you the truth, and the truth hurts. It really does. It's like supporting Ireland in the rugby. You thought they were in the World Cup.
Okay, this is what it is. Now it's clear. This is what's underscoring this podcast today.
New Zealand always win.
Still upset about the Rugby World Cup. Listen, what I was going to say earlier on when I was trying to interrupt you is that you are a contrary character, right? Like, I would love to be able to, we need to find the podcast from a year ago or 2 years ago when you talked about how Google was definitely going to be divested of its ad tech assets. Mm-hmm. These are the reasons that it should happen. Mm-hmm. These are the reasons that, legislators and anti-competition authorities should be considering it. And this is how you could potentially do it.
Yeah.
Now, you've gone on in your intervening, in between when I wanted to interrupt you and now, your intervening 15-minute rant to, highlight that you, as far as I can tell, still think that, right? You still think that that would be the right thing to do. What makes you think that legislative bodies are not capable of that? Aside from the pace at which they move, what makes you think that they're not capable of doing that?
Google are smarter. They're smarter. They managed to get, like, how DoubleClick was allowed, that thing was allowed to go, is absolute outrageous.
Because nobody was watching, they didn't understand at the time, it was a long time ago, it was the early days of ad tech. It's a bold statement to say that every single individual that works for Google is smarter than every single individual and legal, you know, expert that works for various governments, legislative authorities, and has no ability to actually work out a way to pull this company apart if it was important enough. Do you not rather think that it's more likely that there are other vested interests at play instead of a lack of absolute ability and intelligence?
So I wouldn't say intelligence is the issue. I would say strategic thinking. Google's thinking 5 years, 10 years out, right? And they're going, okay, we can afford to do this because we're going to be doing this in 5 years, right? So they've already factored in what sort of like GPT and, sorry, AI-based sort of search is going to mean for the entire open web. They've already figured that out.
Fair enough. But the other thing,
that's their day job, right? So they figured that out.
And I think that's a good point, right, is that they've got this long-term strategic capability because they're absolutely and utterly loaded. And that definitely flies in the face of competition authorities, which may well be not always. In fact, you know, the way that they're set up is not that they're politically managed and handled, but they still have to operate within a fairly politicized environment. And we know the politics of the day changes, and it certainly changes more frequently than Google's profit margins do. So, you know, I can see that they're in a stronger position. But I'll ask you this then. What tech companies can you think of in your lifetime that were massive when you were a child are still that big?
I don't have an answer for that.
Yeah. So we have to suppose that this reign that Google has got is not going to last forever. There will be something that will come along that will get in their way. And it's more likely than not, given their powerful position at the moment, that it's not going to be one, you know, giant meteor crashing into them from space. It's far more likely to be a series of events over a period of time that changes their market position. And part of that is quite likely to be regulation. Another part of it will be competition, changing consumer environment, new technologies, not saying that they don't have a big, you know, stake in that market already, but it's unlikely that they are going to be the animal that you describe forever.
Yeah, but the problem I have with a lot of legislators is that they're reactive rather than proactive, right? And that's my issue, right? So the next thing comes around, like AI comes around, and there's been so much investment in AI, but the big tech companies are the ones who are going to benefit the most from it, not incumbents.
For sure, because they've potentially already been working on it, already been using it, already been developing it. They understand the technology much more. You're right about that. But then that's why I said what I said at the start, which is if we, you know, looking back on what we didn't know when Google bought DoubleClick and what we now know, there's a strong chance that legislators have caught up to a certain extent and gone, okay, we can't continue to let this happen. We have to accept that technology is advancing faster than we are, faster than we're capable of keeping pace with, faster than our education systems can keep up with. And so we've got to start creating some kind of legislative structures and environments that account for that. It's not going to be perfect. It's probably going to be quite shit to start with. But that's why it's interesting to see the full suite of measures that they're trying to work on, including standardizing or, you know, setting up some kind of governing principles to standardize, industry bodies and associations that are looking to achieve some kind of parity across the industry.
Agreed. And it's really interesting, like in terms of how I think it's already starting to come in a little bit. I referenced it earlier, but that Microsoft Activision Blizzard acquisition, the CMA originally looked at it because of the cloud gaming angle, not because of, potential clashes with Sony's PlayStation, but because of cloud gaming, which is this incredibly nascent compared to, you know, console, PC and mobile gaming. That's why they looked at it. It was this future thinking, future looking part of the industry, which they did examine, to all credit to them. Now, for various reasons, it has been, you know, that acquisition was there, you know, following approval. And it was rather annoying to see their CEO, Bobby Kotick, grinning like a child who's just been given an extra starburst by his granny at a meeting with Jeremy Hunt just a couple of months after he said the UK is going to become a Death Valley of investment because they had the gall to actually look into this acquisition, which I think that kind of goes to the point that it is really, really difficult for these antitrust regulators, given that, you know, half politicized environment they have to sit in. In terms of the measures, I agree with them. They seem great in theory, but I really think the entire how antitrust is set up as regulation needs to be looked at, whether that's more budget being put into it, whether that is the, you know, consolidating with other national antitrust bodies. But yeah, it's
if Google were taken out of the sell side, I think things would be really interesting. Like I'm just trying to basically get legislators to kind of just keep.
You're not wrong, Ciarán.
To keep on the case here, right? Don't let up. You like it's when you play like a, and I'm going to use a sport analogy. When you play a great team, right? And then Google are a great company, right? But if you've got them on the ground, you want to put your foot in their throat because you want to make sure the job is done. I'm not saying I'm anti-Google, but they run a monopoly. They run the table, right? They control everything, and it's coming out I think for 10 years they gave no guidance on their share prices because they know they could tweak any knob and make loads of money. They run a monopoly, and it's now time to kind of try and break that up, right? And this, I'll backtrack a little bit and say, like, you know, even the case, the ad tech cases in Europe and in the US are a huge evolution for legislators, because years ago that would have just been gobbledygook, right?
Exactly. That's my point, is that we are learning things. You know, it's maybe not fast enough, but it is changing.
The good thing is they can't buy any other companies, but they still control the ecosystem, right? Yep. Like, you know, they're the biggest consumer, one of the biggest consumer product companies in the world, right? Everybody uses their products. We all use them. So, look, I don't know how this case is going. My sense is they'll probably not. The DOJ won't win this case, but we might see them make concessions. But you don't stop. I think the point of this, discussion was don't stop there. Keep on top of them. Don't kick your eye off them, particularly around AI. You know, AI based search. You know, what does that mean for the entire ecosystem? What does that mean for publishers? I think we are in a new age and we have to kind of get used to it. But I've always had the sort of mantra that it was better to live with Google than to go against them. Like, you know, let the regulators do that as best they can.
Yeah, we need to have a more detailed conversation with some regulators, I reckon. Get them on the podcast.
Absolutely. And we'll fire more contrarian pessimism at them then. But we'll move on to a completely different topic now. And that's that new research from Kantar has revealed that British households are increasingly turning to free ad-supported TV or FAST channels. Insights from Entertainment On Demand found that 16% of UK households access FAST services on a weekly basis. Additionally, UK homes subscribed to at least one subscription video on demand platform rose by 500,000 between Q2 and Q3 of this year. So my question to you, Ciarán, is FAST the obvious solution for the adoption of CTV?
Yes. I'll just say yes.
Excellent.
And I'm the reason I'm going to say yes is because I think free ad-supported TV, the acronym FAST, is nothing new, right? We've all grown up with ad-supported TV. If you lived outside the US, you generally grew up with ad-supported TV. We paid bundles is a very American thing. Like, no, nobody really paid for Sky. The lad down the road who had Sky subscription was also seen as the rich people in the town, like, you know, with their, like, you know, fancy English soccer playing every Saturday or whatever. But like, you can see it with the likes of Freely, right, which is the BBC ITV Channel 4 and 5. That's a new sort of like FAST channel, if you will, that would be on all sort of smart TVs. So I do think that's where you're going to see most things. I mean, I think people have different definitions of FAST, sort of outliers like Roku and, you know, LG and Samsung and Rakuten. I don't believe they're going to be the dominant players. I think people will still gravitate towards the national channels in all countries because of regulations, et cetera, et cetera. Like, so, and sports rights and just general sort of like IP, right? That all these channels like ITV and BBC, well, BBC, because like, there's no ads, but like the rest of the cohorts in those specific country markets. So yeah, I think that's where you're going to get the sweet spot for CTV. I think that's where it'll happen. Whether it's not, now the question you have to ask yourself is what that looks like. So, you know, we have a bunch of companies who are engaged in SPO, right? So is it just a DSP to ad server? Will it be the DSP to SSP? Like, where, what does that market look like? But I do think that the sort of, you know, data-driven buying, if you will, the ability to kind of like ad serve ads with data overlaid, I think that's where, I think FAST will be the sweet spot for the host, for the CTV spot.
Yeah, I mean, I'd have to agree with that. I just think that FAST audiences are going to grow a lot over the next couple of years. You know, I concur with Ciaran on the notion that it's a kind of natural way to consume television for most people outside the US. So it's, you know, there's a very natural level of tolerance for advertising in that environment, even from younger people who tend to consume more television in a YouTube environment or any other kind of like online streaming platform. I still think there's a strong pull towards those traditional broadcasting brands. Brands because they also have the ability to create content in ways that some of the other streaming providers don't necessarily have, or have, you know, most of the content that those streaming providers can create comes at a premium, you know, subscription-funded tier that I just don't think consumers are going to tolerate. I think there's everything in any economic sort of outlook and, you know, guesswork, I'm going to say. I'm going to stop calling it forecasting because it really is just guesswork, to suggest that people's budgets are going to be tight for quite some time to come. You know, inflation is coming down, but not very fast. Interest rates are probably stabilizing, but they're going to stay where they are or potentially even creep a little bit higher for quite a while. We're not talking about a major correction in 12 months' time. It's probably going to be at least 24 months before things start to look different. And in that time, people are going to be really careful with where they spend their money. So more audiences are going to go to FAST. And I think that just creates a better opportunity for those broadcasters and those content providers to create some, you know, to obviously build their advertising revenue in that kind of environment, contribute it towards creating some knock it out the park content, right? Like, we're coming up to a really good content season here in the UK. Autumn's always really exciting. You get lots of the start of various seasons that are returning, various seasonal style content, lots of sport happening. There's loads of eyeballs moving to FAST channels. And also, you know, the advertising experience has improved significantly in such a short period of time. I mean, Rugby World Cup, who's been watching loads of ITVX lately? I have. I'm telling you, even last year, what was it last year? Was it European Championships or World Cup? European. What was it?
Yeah, the Euros,
European,
I think,
Cup,
it was.
Wasn't it? Yeah. Euros, yeah. And ITV, like, it was just, they're worlds apart in a 12-month period of time. Mm. The advertising experience is just so much better, yeah. So much more seamless.
Totally agree.
And that's great news. It's great news for consumers too. I barely noticed it. It just felt like the old days of watching telly. Ad comes on, oh, go make a cup of tea. So I think that is a real opportunity for CTV.
Yeah, and look, there's been a lot of debate around, you know, the Netflix strategy. They're hiking the price up because they can, because nobody's dropping Netflix, because in fairness, Netflix is a go-to for a lot of people, right? But all the sort of other sort of, you know, other streaming services, a lot of people are kind of wondering whether they should just dump Disney, because for most people, you're kind of like pivoting between Star Wars IP and Marvel IP, right? If you know kids, and like, to be honest with you, does it really matter? Because like, BBC has a kids channel and there's lots of content elsewhere. You don't necessarily like Disney, for me, seems to be like, will be a natural call for people. Amazon Prime will probably, people will keep that and have the free channel, but after that you're struggling. Like Now TV, I suppose you keep if you're, you know, into the sports from Sky, but then it's, you know, there's nothing else really, you know? And then I think people will, to your point, Rich, I think people will, because ITV is still massive draw in this country, as is like RTL in Europe and RT in
Channel
Ireland.
Channel 4, like, Canal, like, these are huge, all of that stuff.
Huge, they
is
still have
really...
huge pull. People would will watch Dancing on Ice and Ant and Dec.
Dancing Rick. On Ice. Is we it have, actually called that?
We have great fun in here about the Ant and Dec pull. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you know, there's people up in Grimsby that'll get fish and chips and watch it. I've never watched them. Like, seen them. I think one of them was on for drunk driving there recently. Like, that was the last time.
Recently, I think that was years ago now.
But you know, there's still a huge pull, hey. And I think ITV, you know, I think they've done a really good job of building the stack and improving the ad experience. And to be honest, I think ITVX in general is really good. I watch a lot of sports, so. Obviously, the Rugby World Cup has been, you know, go to, and I thought the ad experience was, and they do a lot around the horse racing, like Cheltenham and the National. I think they just do a brilliant job.
Yeah, they've, I agree.
It's really good quality content, and that's why I think, like, the death of TV has been sort of massively talked up. Brian Rees has done some brilliant stuff around, you know, streaming is capturing a lot of value, but I think Netflix is going to struggle with an ads business. I just think that the model is wrong. I just think the people in this part of the world will not pay to watch advertising, right? They know there's a Faustian trade-off where you are happy to watch TV and watch ads for free, but people have an aversion to paying for, you know, a half-arsed product, right? Like, oh, I'll watch one or two ads. I go, I'm not entirely sure people will want to have 2 years. I'm wrong, but I think you're
partly right about that. I think the key will be the price point, right? And I don't think they've got it right just yet. And I think it's partly because they're not willing to admit, you know, what price it's going to take for people to actually sign up to those, you know, pay for ads bundles, because it's just a completely different proposition. And it's also, like I said earlier on, a price sensitive market. So, you know, whilst there's some competition out there that you don't have to pay for, you've got to really up your game. So, I just think also on the content production thing, one final point on the content production, I've got a few friends that work in television, and I mean, you made a good point about children's TV and BBC funded children's TV. Like, it's top quality, right? And friends that work in production of children's TV just talk about how the BBC are more competitive globally on children's television than they've ever been before in their lives.
There's no Dougie on Sky, and there's no Dougie on Disney.
Yeah.
That dog is smart. People like
it. Yeah, perhaps we should get Dougie on the podcast too. Dougie.
But he doesn't. He doesn't speak. He just barks.
Oh.
And the narrator then sort of translates what he says.
Interprets. Well, okay, that could be. That's a bit
all
like
the kids
you
speak.
And me.
All the kids speak, but the dog. But the dog doesn't. He speaks in dog.
Great.
Yes, I think Dougie's a perfect and wonderfully optimistic note to end this week's podcast on. But Kieran and Rachel, it's been absolutely wonderful to listen to your thoughts, and, you know, ranging from toilets to toothpicks and tanks, it's been an absolute blast. So thank you both ever so much.
The three T's, yeah, no worries. That was good
toilets,
fun.
Tanks and toothpicks.
Toothpicks.
I think that's the name of a bar or maybe or some really random store that sells just those items.
Toilets, toilets, toothpicks.
It's quite a niche market, but I'm sure they'll
for
themselves.
Forget the toucan. That's where we're going to have our pre Mexico drinks next year.
Maybe
toilets,
we should call it the
toothpicks,
toilets, the tanks, and toothpicks. And maybe sell all those items at the bar. I'll give one away with a free pint of Guinness at the toucan next year. That would actually be quite hilarious.
Well, and you could randomly get a toilet or a toothpick or a tank.
Be like
just
miniature toilets.
A lucky dip.
Miniature toilets.
I'm glad they're miniature. I'm just picturing the entire great and good of ad tech just standing outside the toucan clutching a massive ceramic
bowl. Toilet. Well, I don't know what we're going to do for tanks. Anyway.
No, you get those little toy tanks and then toothpicks. By God, this is, you'll get this on
what
the merch store. We're launching the merch store.
Oh, dear God, Matt, save us. Wrap it up.
We've got an absolute runner here. We're going to go away and work on these ideas. But yeah, thank you all ever so much for listening. That was this week's WANT Tech Podcast.